You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. I get to say that, Don. It broke 70 degrees last week.
You absolutely get to say that. It is suddenly spring in the Sacramento Valley. As we speak, gardeners are coming out of their winter dormancy and heading out to garden centers and looking for things that aren't there. Temperature right now. Okay, backing up. We're recording this on March 4th, 2026 for broadcast March 5th, 2026, which technically is still in winter by the calendar, although meteorological spring has begun. It is going up to a high today of 67 degrees. Tomorrow will be a high of 64 degrees and breezy. We're actually going to have a north wind, and we haven't really had much north wind recently, so people may have kind of forgotten what this is like. We're going to have gusts 15 to 22 miles an hour, all the way up to 32 miles an hour in some areas on Thursday, clearing on Thursday night. The wind will continue through the night as high as 28 miles an hour. This is relevant because a lot of you have recently planted seed, grass seed, wildflowers, things like that. You should give them a good soaking each morning and again midday if you have recently planted things that are in the process of germinating outside, especially when the wind is blowing. Two, three times during a day like that wouldn't be a bad idea. The breeze will continue into Friday, 68 degrees, and then finally dropping down. The winds will drop down Friday night. It's going to get to about 49 degrees. Saturday, sunny with a high near 73. Putting the word out, nurseries in Northern California, staff up. Okay, Saturday night will be mostly clear with a low around 46 degrees. Sunday, sunny with a high near 75 degrees.
And that's the highest we've been this year.
Oh, yes. Yes, by definitely. So just a quick note here. Let's go over to weatherspark.com and see what we normally would be on a Sunday, March 8th, would normally be 63 degrees. Okay, so we're talking about 75 degrees. The nights, however, 46 degrees is almost exactly our average low temperature this time of year. So we're going to have about a 25, 30 degree spread in temperature. The days are going to feel sunny and warm, and the nights are going to cool off rather markedly by comparison. Sunday night will be 47. Monday will be 74. Monday night will be 49, and Tuesday will be 70. Let's head on over to Weather Underground and see what they're saying, because they tend to be on the higher end of things. And they're saying we're going to go up to, are you ready for this on Sunday? 78. Degrees on Sunday, according to Weather Underground. There is no rain on the horizon. We did have 2.68 inches of rain in February, none to speak of course, in March yet. We generally get 2 to 3 inches of rain in the month of March. Questions I've been getting recently, and this is a timely topic, is chilling hours. Since the traditional method for measuring chilling hours went from November 1 to February 28. So using that method, the regular method of 32 to 45 degrees, how many chilling hours did we have this year? If we're going to pretend that the season ends on February 28th, 908, which for the record, using that model, which I have been tracking for about 40 plus years, is about 100 degrees above average.
100 degrees above average.
100, excuse me, hours.
Oh.
Thank you.
Yes. You were going to worry me there.
Important correction. Yes. We normally average about 800 chilling hours here using the traditional 32 to 45 degree method. This year we had 908. The Utah model is a more expansive model. First, it was observed that the dormancy effect of chilling goes down to about 34 degrees not 32 degrees. More importantly, the chilling benefits to going through completing dormancy and blooming properly expands up to 50 degrees. So the Utah model, which is considered to be rather more accurate in terms of how plants actually perform, is 34 to 50 degrees. We've had, using the Utah model, 1,326.5 chilling hours. And so the difference there is the number of hours where we were above 45, but below 50. Mm-hmm. And this is the biggest disparity I've ever seen between these two models, where it's 908 chilling hours by the usual method and 1,328, roughly 1,326.5 by the Utah method, because we had a bunch of days there where it was above 45 and below 50. So
for the whole 24 hours.
Yes. The entire 24 hours were 24 chilling hours using the Utah method. And we know the Utah model is probably more accurate with respect to how trees actually perform. 1,326.5 chilling hours should cover pretty much any kind of fruit tree you're growing in this area. They're mostly, let's say, stone fruit, 600 to 700 chilling hour requirements, in many cases lower than that, in a few cases higher than that. The group that tend to need more chilling hours are apples, pears, cherries. Even there, you have varieties that are fine with lower chilling hours. And we do know that many will perform fine with lower than expected chilling hours. Bottom line, we got plenty of chilling hours this year. Nothing to worry about.
Don, I have a question. You said there's going to be a north wind coming.
Yeah.
And I got little tiny Japanese maple seedlings. Mm-hmm. That sprouted up, and I put them in little tiny six packs and held them over the winter. And I planned to, I noticed the past tense, I had planned
to get them
put in the ground before they leafed out. Well, they're little tiny little things, but they got little tiny leaves on them. So yesterday, about half of them, that's about 30. What? I'm going to have a Japanese maple hedge.
Okay. You know,
not Japanese a hedge, just Japanese. A barrier. Anyway, so I put them out. They're underneath other things. So they're going, you know, they're shaded and they're fine. But what do I have to worry about with the north wind? Now, it's under things. So it's not like right out in the open field or anything.
Right. That helps a lot. I mean, it's somewhat protected from the wind. But the biggest difference that people will notice, even on your skin, is that we're going to be very low humidity. And we haven't had those periods of low humidity. Anybody who moves here from the coastal zone or a more humid Midwestern climate, the first thing you notice when you get here is that there are periods where the humidity here is similar to a desert. It can be down, you know, 10, 20% humidity. And, you know, for the last 3 months, we've been 70, 80% humidity. We had 5 weeks where it was 100% humidity. So you are going to notice a slight difference. And more to the point, young seedlings that are just leafing out will notice that difference. Plants that are flushing new growth, you might see some burn on the margins, even with soil moisture adequate. Things you've recently transplanted, you should definitely check the soil irrigation. I've got a whole bunch of young tree seedlings that I planted out in the fall out on the farm, and I'll be going out and hand watering each of them with a gallon or two of water probably today, and again perhaps Sunday morning, just because although I know there's soil moisture, I disrupted the soil where those were planted. I broke up the soil, so it's likely to have dried out enough that it will need an irrigation. Your whole yard does not need to be watered yet. Your sprinklers don't need to be on typically. Wouldn't be a bad idea to run through them, turn them on, check them, see how the coverage is. Newly planted turf should be irrigated. Newly planted seedlings or newly transplanted seedlings that you're, such as you're describing, should be checked daily and watered as needed. Probably don't need it daily, but they might while that north wind is blowing. So this is the key. When we tell you to check daily, this is part of it, is that we live in a place where the weather can change pretty dramatically in terms of plant water needs. Plant evapotranspiration rate can spike up. And the water as needed part is a direct response to those changes in evapotranspiration. Hand watering newly planted things will probably be necessary sometime this week. Maybe only once. That may be all you need to do, because we're not going to be that hot, that windy. You know, this isn't a summer event, but you should check the soil moisture. So here's the thing. At this time of year, it's very unlikely that the results of what we often call overwatering would even occur. Mm-hmm. All right. So people are concerned about overwatering. Well, that's, of course, our most common conversation from about May through October. I hate to use the term overwatering. I think we've made this point before.
Keeping
it too damp around the plant during the high temperature conditions leading to infection by Phytophthora crown rot doesn't just trip off the tongue as easily as overwatering does, but overwatering is a misnomer. The term refers to creating moisture conditions next to the stem that cause Phytophthora spores, which are motile, to be able to swim over to the stem and infect under the bark. And that happens under high temperature conditions, not under low temperature conditions. And by high temperature conditions, I don't mean a day in the low 70s. I mean days in the 90s. So I'm not real concerned about it. If you happen to want to turn your system on for 5 minutes each day for some reason, you're not going to drown a plant. You're not going to cause crown rot. You're just wasting water. But it isn't going to hurt anything. And so for people who have recently planted turf, people who have recently planted wildfires, yeah, set your timer for 5 minutes each morning, let it go for now, especially through this week when we might have a dry north wind. And that goes for interior Southern California, where you get the same kind of events. Or if the Santa Ana winds hit you down there, which often happens when we're having north winds up here, we're sharing a weather system that you need, you know, if you've lived with Santa Ana winds, that you have to get out there and water, check the soil, wash the plants off if it's really gusty and windy, because the humidity is going to be so low that the nice, tender, new spring leaves can be burned or damaged. Mostly a cosmetic thing, but we can prevent that to some degree.
So I hear that there are events happening with the Master Gardeners.
Yes, we have an event about plant communication. So
what do you mean plant communication?
Yeah, so if you want to learn,
do they communicate?
Apparently, on March 12th, you can go to an event featuring Dr. Rick Carbon, a UC Davis Distinguished Professor Emeritus. This will be held at the Yolo County Library in the Blanchard Room. He'll talk about communication between plants that allows them to fine-tune their defenses against herbivorous insects. Meaning
herbivorous insects, caterpillars.
They're going to
stop the hordes of caterpillars from invading. Well, no, I don't think so.
At least they're going to talk about it. So plants are sensitive to many cues in the environment. They respond in ways that increase their growth and reproduction. This will be a fascinating lecture, it says here, and I agree. That sounds like an interesting topic. A chance to hear a presentation by an internationally recognized authority on plant communication. For information about these things, I found this at the Yolo County Master Gardeners website. There is contact information there, but you can mark your calendar. This is an in-person presentation, March 12th, 2026, from 4 to 5 p.m., plant communication. Right, gardening for year-round meals is coming up on March 14th. Sun mapping your garden. Karen Slinker, UC Master Gardener of Yolo County, will talk about sun mapping your garden. Sun mapping. Looking where
the sun is going to hit the garden at different times of the year.
Ideal germination conditions for vegetable seeds, edible flowers to add to your garden and meals. Karen will share her experience from more than 50 years of gardening in Yolo County. This class meets at the Grace Garden behind the United Methodist Church on Anderson Road. They plan to be outside, but can move inside if necessary. And that is March, what did I just say?
14th.
Thank you. From 11 a.m. to noon at the Grace Garden on Anderson Road.
So we were talking at one point about Italian arum, and I forgot the common name of that. What's the common name of that?
My grandmother called it lords and ladies.
Lords and ladies. It's a I don't know.
I don't either. I don't know where that name comes from. It's a calla lily relative. So the leaves look like calla lily leaves, although they're more attractive. And I think that may be what it was originally planted for.
And the flowers are spath and spagellum.
Yeah, they look like a slightly boring calla lily. They're not bright.
They're jack in the pulpit.
Yeah, they're not bright, clean white like a regular calla lily or those colorful ones you sometimes see at the florist shops. But you can see from the structure, you quickly recognize the relationship. Yeah.
Anyway, we talked about that.
Yeah.
And Nancy, who had sent the original question, she's from Davis. She wrote back and said, I was out of town last week, so I wasn't able to listen to the show live. So I just now listened to the recording. Oh, it is handy to have those things. Thank you for doing that.
Yep.
Thanks for the information. Yeah, it's not an easy thing to get rid of. But try to be diligent digging it out over the next few years.
Yep.
Actually, it's kind of satisfying to dig them out and then yell, die, plant, die, as I do. Thanks. I always learn so much from your show.
Okay,
thanks. Thanks, Nancy, for
In theory, you could smother them. In theory, but the most difficult weeds that we deal with are the ones that have some sort of a propagule from which they resprout vegetatively. I mean, when I gave a long seminar on weed management a couple of years ago, actually a training seminar for pest control applicators, and there were a couple of key points, and the one that I really kept harping on was every weed has its own adaptive strategy, or the how is this critter outwitting us question. And in many cases, it's just massive seed production. You know, that's what makes a plant invasive in many cases, is just one plant producing thousands of seeds which have high viability. In many
Bed straw.
cases, bed straw, well, in the case of bed straw, it actually, I talked about that one specifically at this seminar, a very long germination period. They start sprouting in October, and new seedlings can still come up in February, March, which is unusual. More commonly, annual weeds have a particular period of germination, which is the best time to strategize for, you know, preventing them. And you can go out in October, November, smother them, whatever, spray them, hoe them, whatever you're going to do, and get good control. But bed straw in particular continues to germinate even in December, January, and as late as late February. So you have to keep after that one. But in the case, the really difficult ones that I can think about, Bermuda grass, nutsedge, the Oxalis Bermuda buttercup that's all over the place, their adaptive strategy is one of the most challenging, which is that they have a bulb. Or in the case of Bermuda grass, a stolon, which can resprout even from a node. Nutsedge, same thing. There's a little bulb down there, down at the base of, at the end of the root. And so when you pull the plant, in the case of nutsedge or oxalis or this arum, you're leaving a bunch of bulbs behind. Usually you'll then have more plants in that spot than the one you pulled out. So it seems like an endless process. It is not hopeless to pull them. This is important to know. You can, at least in theory, starve out a plant by continuously removing the top or by continuously burying the top. In other words, if you prevent photosynthesis, the plant will eventually die. It's the eventually part. I mean, I've consulted way back when I was a magazine editor for the American Bamboo Society. People say, how long does it take to get rid of a big stand of bamboo? Well, 3 to 5 years. Okay, 3 to 5 years of consistent removal. Well, you can get rid of a big stand of bamboo if you're not going to use chemicals, you're not going to dig it up. Keep cutting it, smothering it, cutting it, smothering it. Well, the same will be true of this arum pictum. Dig it out as best you can. A little shoot will come up, bury it. I mean, at the very least, chop it off. It does help. Bury it if you can, because that makes it even harder for it to get out. And then keep digging it out as you have to. In the case of this particular arum, there are fewer bulbs left behind. So with diligence and a little enthusiasm, I like that die plant part of it. You should get good results over about a 2 to 5 year period, depending on how bad your stand is from the start.
Even if you bury it, it may lie dormant until it's time to come back.
Bulbs can be delightfully long-lived, and sometimes that's a pleasant thing, sometimes it's an unpleasant thing. I mean, I remember when we cleared out a whole overgrown area of brambleberries at one point. I had a couple of teenagers. I handed each of them two machetes. It was an amazing thing to watch, and nobody went to the hospital. It was all fine, but they chopped it all out completely. This is like a 30 by a 30 foot area that had been completely
Wow.
overgrown with roses and blackberries. And so they spent a couple of days chopping it all down. Then I dug out and I counted 200 berry plants, got rid of all those, and watered the whole area to see, watch what would come up and deal with it. And up popped a single lone tulip. It had been in the ground at least a decade without growing or blooming. But all of a sudden, I'd removed all of that stuff above it and it came up and bloomed. And I thought, I wish I'd had a digital camera in those days because it was a real survivor if ever there was one. So bulbs can be a remarkable adaptive strategy. And when it's something we like tulips, great. When it's something we don't like nutsedge or lords and ladies or that type of thing, well, that just makes them harder
Well,
to get rid of. Okay, thanks for the follow-up. Good luck with your lords and ladies.
it's that time of year when there are lots and lots and lots and lots of things blooming.
Yes.
And as every new kind of flower comes out, people will rush in and ask questions of Don. And sometimes they had a phone and sometimes they didn't. So here's one of those questions. Remember, this is March 4th. What is that yellow vine that's blooming right now?
Carolina jessamine is the likeliest. Gelsemium sempervirens. It's a fragrance kind of like jasmine. So, of course, as the name suggests, it's from the southeastern United States, and it has a very early yellow bloom, February, March, generally done by the end of March. I always need to mention, the reason I don't stock this plant is because before anyone buys it, I want them to know that it's toxic to honeybees. kills them. So, and it's also toxic to livestock. So, you know, that's probably not an issue for most home gardeners, but it is a poisonous plant. And so once I get done saying that, they no longer want it. So I don't keep them in stock. But that is one of the yellow flowering vines you're seeing in the area. Almost the exact same color shade of primrose yellow is the primrose jasmine, Jasminum mesnii. Jasminum primulinum is a name I've seen it sold under to reflect the primrose yellow color of the flowers, but I believe Jasminum mesnii is the approved botanical name. That's a big sprawling vine, about the same dark green as the jessamine, less shiny. The jessamine is shinier, and a bright yellow flowers very, very early. Even though it's in the genus Jasminum, it is not fragrant. So it's a scentless jasmine, and big, as I say, not a vine that scrambles or twines. It's a big arching, sprawling shrub, sort of Lady Banks-like. I mean, it's one of those plants. You put it next to the structure, you tie it to the structure, it functions as a vine, but what you really have is a great big open, sprawling shrub. And the other yellow flower that's just about open. Now, it's early March, so we're about 1 to 2 weeks ahead of schedule on this, if we're opening, would be the yellow version of Lady Banks Rose. The Rosa Banksia comes in a white double flower, white single flower, yellow double flower, and yellow single flowered versions. And the two that are most common are the double flowered white and the double flowered yellow. The double flowered yellow will be opening. They could have some blooms popping, I suppose, in some areas. I think we're at least a week to 10 days away on those. My single flowered white Lady Banks Rose has just opened a few blooms. I'm looking out the window. Oh, it's a little further along than it was. So they're getting out there and you're getting the fragrance from them. The yellow flowered one smells like cotton candy, as does the single petaled white one. The double flowered white one barely has any scent at all. So if you want a fragrant Lady Banks Rose, look for the yellow one. If you're more you just want a great big vigorous plant with lots of blooms, plant the old-fashioned double white one. But Rosa Banksia lutea, the yellow Lady Banks Rose, is probably opening now and could have been open, I suppose, on the day they asked the question.
Okay, I'm looking for a weed killer that's safe. My neighbors use salt on all their weeds. Is that okay? Is that safe?
No. It's a terrible thing to do.
Why?
Because salt damages the soil. It causes actual structural changes to the soil. It for the plants that remain behind, the ones you weren't trying to kill that happen to have roots nearby, it damages their roots and makes it difficult, actually, believe it or not, for them to take up moisture. You're damaging the root hairs in a pretty sustained manner. I mean, the damage you do is there for as long as the salt is present in the root zone. Good news, sodium chloride is soluble. So if someone has applied salt in one way or another, sprinkling it on the plant, spraying it on, you name it, all these different internet fads that we see, if you water thoroughly, you can at least get it out of the root zone and minimize any further damage. But it damages the plants in the area and it does structural damage to the soil. The salt is bad for the soil. Don't use it. Now we got a fun question here, and I got this twice in the matter of 2 weeks. So I wanted to go over this one and spend a little more time on this. For those of you who like lavender.
Oh, lavender is a lovely scent. Well, some of them are not so. Wait a minute. Lavender is a whole genus, isn't it?
It is a large genus. Boy, if you want to get into plants that communicate, we're talking about that topic that they're going to have in a Master Gardeners program. Lavender epitomizes the use of volatile organic compounds, which almost everything in the mint family does, and it's in the mint family. They have volatile organic compounds that are produced in the leaves, in the petals, in the sepals, in the stems. It varies from one species to another. And lavenders, of course, are grown primarily for the fragrance of the flowers, although the plants are outstanding landscape plants here in most parts of California because they can take drought, they can take extreme heat. They're okay in the coastal zones. They're fine there. They bloom just as well on the coast as they do in the interior. They mix nicely with our California native plants and with plants from South Africa and so on. And there are lots and lots and lots of species in the genus Lavandula. The one question that I got twice in a couple weeks was,
do you have French lavender?
And I've learned that when people say this, unless they're very knowledgeable gardeners, they don't mean French lavender. They don't mean Lavandula dentata, which is French lavender. Just for the record, almost every country in Europe seems to have a lavender named after it.
And it's the wrong country.
Well, some of them are right, some are wrong. Like English lavender, there's no lavender that's native to England, but that's the lavender that we all grow and that we call that English lavender. But the one that's called French lavender, true use of that common name, if you will, is Lavandula dentata. That tells you that the leaves are dentate. They're toothed. meaning they're not smooth on the margins. They have toothed margins. So it's very easy to tell from other lavenders. The flowers are very lightly scented. The foliage is green and fragrant. The foliage is fragrant. It's a nice plant, but it's not what they're thinking of. If I had it in stock and took them over to look at it, they'd say, huh, this doesn't look like what I'm thinking of. No, what you're thinking of is a lavender called Provence.
Oh, that's French.
Or possibly one called Grosso, which are grown heavily in France.
Uh-huh.
They're hybrids of English lavender. Okay.
Oh. So we have English lavender grown in France, named for a French town Spanish something.
Yeah, Provence.
That's so confusing, Don. So
English lavender is generally found under the species Lavandula angustifolia, although the old name of Lavandula vera, which just means true, or Lavandula officinalis. Herbal usage type when you see that on there. Those are old names for English lavender. And there are a number of varieties of actual English lavender that are very popular. Hidecote, named after a garden. Munstead, likewise named after a garden. Lady, which you can grow from seed. Twickle Purple. Those are four dwarf English lavenders that have become very popular. They stay compact. They have real strong purple flowers. And they have that special fragrance that most people are after. So those are garden varieties of English lavender. And they're all very good ones. And some of them, two of them in particular, Hidecote and Munstead, come true from seed. So they're often grown from seed and relatively economical. Many other lavenders have to be grown from cuttings. In other words, they're clonally propagated cultivars. So they might be a little more expensive. But those ones in particular, when Lady Lavender came on the market, you can find this in seed catalogs. We grew it right away. It's a great garden plant. It gets about 18 inches by about 24 inches. It blooms nonstop through the summer. Nice compact growth habit and so forth. And so it's an inexpensive one that you can grow. And if you're in an area where it rains in the summer and lavender is kind of marginal for you, be a great one to try, because you wouldn't be putting a whole lot of cost into something that might rot on you. So those are good options. But hybrids of English lavender and a lavender called spike lavender, Lavandula lactifolia. Most people have never grown that one, but it was crossed with English lavender, hybridized with it to make some of the most fragrant lavender plants. And sometimes you'll find these called lavendin rather than lavender, to indicate somehow that they're hybrids, not just selections of English lavender. And these are probably the most widely planted. Grosso, in particular, is grown commercially for oil and for perfume. It says, Sunset Western Garden Book says, possibly the most fragrant lavendin of all. So Grosso. And then Provence, which I can tell you, I've grown them side by side, and they're not the easiest thing to tell apart. They're very, very similar, slight differences between them. Grosso flowers, spikes are fatter, hence the name. Otherwise, very similar in color, exceptionally fragrant. Provence looks a lot like Grosso, a little bit darker foliage, a little bit skinnier flowers, also a very good one. If you're looking for the lavender you're thinking of, is probably Grosso or Provence. And we've just barely scratched the surface of lavenders that are out there. At one point, 15 plus years ago, I made a complete list of all the lavenders available to me from my three or four different wholesalers that grew them.
That was a book.
There were at least 30 on that list. And then I published it up on the website. And the next availability list, there were like three or four more that I hadn't even included. So there's a lot of breeding and introduction in the world of lavenders that you as gardeners can select from. And it gets a little confusing. I just want to mention one other group, because you're seeing them now. That's the Spanish lavender. So we've talked French, which aren't French. We've talked English, which aren't from England. This one is from Spain. Okay, so it's accurately named Lavandula stoicus, the very first lavender to bloom. They only get a foot and a half tall. They spread 2 to 3 feet across. The very first of those that came on the market in a big way was called Otto Quast. It really caught on because these have, if you look at a lavender inflorescence, it's a spike with a bunch of very tightly packed, very small flowers. So it itself is not real showy, but there's a lot of them and they smell wonderful. The Spanish lavender has a little flag on each of those inflorescences. There's a bract that's on the top that is big and showy. Sometimes there's two of them or even three of them. And so suddenly you have a flower that stands out more. And the Spanish lavender really does stand out more for its visible and attractive purple flowers. That one really caught on, became very popular. Bedding plant growers discovered they could take cuttings of that or do it from seed and put them in little pots, like 4-inch pots or quart-sized pots, and they would bloom. Well, that works for the bedding plant industry. Let me tell you, something that blooms in a pot will sell itself. We all know that. So it became very, very popular. And breeders started introducing others. There's a series out there that a lot of you will see, particularly in Home Depot and Lowe's and other places like that. The Madrid series. Quick, which country is Madrid in?
Spain.
Very good. So there's Spanish lavender. That's a trademark name. There's, I think, a dozen of them now in the Madrid series. There's pink, there's white, there's some very cool ones. It has even more of these bright, showy, flag-like bracts on each inflorescence and an even tighter growth habit. So these are great garden plants. You can pack them in a container because they stay nice and tight. And the only drawback is that, to me, they smell like turpentine.
They smell bad.
Yeah, turpentine. They're very resinous smell. So it's not something that you're going to cut and bring in and go, ooh, that wonderful lavender for potpourri. The fragrance is not all that pleasant. Some people like it. Most people find it a little off-putting, but they're very showy and they bloom early. And they're just finishing up their heavy bloom when these other lavenders we've talked about are starting to come into bloom. So if, like me, you've decided at some point in your career that you want to plant lavenders to have bloom for the entire growing season, I did this, and you start with the Spanish lavender, and then you have the English lavender, and then you have the English lavendins. And the other one I would add to this mix would be the Goodwin Creek, which is a UC Arboretum All-Star, and it's a great garden plant that's partially French lavender parentage, blooms later, big plant, nice fragrant foliage. If you did all four of those in a nice big mixed planting, you can go out there almost any time between late February and early fall and find some kind of lavender in bloom. And if you want the fragrant ones, you'll have blooms all summer and into the early fall. So there's a lavender for every situation. The key thing to look at when you're choosing where it's going to go and which one you're going to plant is how big does it get? Because some lavender plants are as much as 4x4. Goodwin Creek is a good example. It's a great landscape plant, but it's big. Others are very tight, and some of them, like these Spanish lavenders, are great for containers if you're into, you know, colorful container, mixed container plantings, but they don't have the fragrance that you're after. So you have to decide what your criteria are. Two that have come on the market that I think are worth looking for are variants of Grosso that occurred, I think, just spontaneously, that proved to be a little more vigorous, a little more disease resistant, a little more consistent color to the foliage, and we're proving to be very satisfactory in colder winter areas where lavender usually frees back, or in areas that rain in the summer where they have issues with crown rot. Phenomenal and sensational. Great words. Easy to remember. Apparently just forms of Grosso that are better, and they're worth looking for. I've grown these. If you want to see examples of them, 15 years ago, we planted, no, 2012 when it first came out. So what is that? Yeah, 14 years ago. We planted some right in front of the building next door to where our nursery is, and just on the sidewalk strip. I mean, the oven cooker sidewalk strip, white wall facing south with sidewalk next to it. And for 10 years, they were spectacular. They're finally aging out of that location, as lavender will do. They're getting kind of woody and falling apart. We may try cutting them back, or we might just replace them. But over a decade of bloom in a spot that was easily 100 plus degrees every day in the summer, did great. Sometimes the irrigation system was working, sometimes it wasn't. They were fine with that as well. So Phenomenal and Sensational are two relatively new lavender cultivars that are worth looking for, especially if you're sort of outside of the Mediterranean climate zone that we're in. If you're in a rainier climate, the company that introduced Phenomenal and Sensational is in Pennsylvania. And they were introducing them to sell to growers back east, where lavender are popular but challenging because of summer rainfall. Those two turned out to be very good ones for them as well. So those of you in those climates where it rains in the summer, look for Phenomenal, Sensational, get them planted, take some pictures, and send us a report. DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
Prunus crouter Vesuvius. That's an amazing name, Don. That's just an amazing name.
Ah, yes. Part of our ongoing series, What's That Tree? The picture I sent to you is actually an ornamental plum. This one is the red leaf or purple leaf plum. We have just finished the earliest of the flowering plums, Prunus bleriana. We talked about that a couple weeks ago when it first started blooming. It's got semi-double flowers. That's a term we use for a single flower is 5 petals. Semi-double is maybe 10 petals. Fully double is a whole bunch of petals. You don't even see the anthers and the pollen.
It's fluffy. That's what it is. Yeah.
And so the semi-double one is showy. It's a light pink. It's one of the very first trees to bloom in this area. It's, in my opinion, one of the best of the flowering trees for our region. The next ones are just blooming now. The picture I sent to Lois, I took yesterday.
It's so pretty, Don. I mean, this is just, it's a single petal flower. Yeah. It's got red anthers in it. It's the palest of pinks. Yeah. This is gorgeous.
Yeah, and it looks very pretty, very much like the other one, although not each flower isn't as big and showy, but the profusion of bloom, the whole plant is pink. This is the one that's grown more commonly for the red or purplish leaves. It's called the red leaf plum or purple leaf plum. And of the several red leaf plums on the market, this one has the least fruit, which is an important characteristic. Crouter Vesuvius, K-R-A-U-T-E-R, Vesuvius, like the mountain or volcano. That Crouter Vesuvius is the red leaf plum or purple leaf plum sold most commonly now because it has the lightest fruit crop. It's not completely fruitless, but it's generally not a heavy crop. And if anything, you'll get some fruit on the ground. Whereas the original red leaf and purple leaf plums that came on the market in the 1950s and 60s, Thundercloud, Newport, some of the other older varieties, set very heavy crops. I mean, like a carpet of fruit rotting on the ground underneath them, which was a big unselling point.
And they weren't very edible. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, you could eat them. They're not toxic.
Even the birds weren't all that attracted to them.
I remember articles in Sunset Magazine back in the 1970s when it was our leading publication about all things horticultural, things you could do with the fruit of your purple leaf plum. Yeah, you could turn them into jam or something, but they're kind of astringent. They're edible. Kids like to eat them. But this one barely fruits. So that's, if you want that real red, I'll say dark red, burgundy, purple leaf plant, that's the one you're looking at that's blooming now. Prunus bleriana, the one we talked about a couple weeks ago, is completely sterile. I've never seen fruit on it. So if that's a really important factor, that would be another selling point of that particular flowering plum. And again, that one, of all the flowering cherries, crab apples, flowering plums, that whole category of small flowering trees, I think the flowering plum, Prunus bleriana, is probably one of the least problematic, best mannered for most landscapes. And it also accepts some drought. Most of them don't. It's not hard to prune or manage, and it's not a huge tree. So if you're looking for a decorative flowering tree for the Sacramento Valley, it's one of my favorites for that purpose. Very little litter and so on. It doesn't have the disease problems you get on crab apples. It doesn't have the irrigation stress issues that you have with flowering cherries. So I think it's one of the best. But these red leaf plums have this nice bonus of being very showy when they're in bloom. So Prunus Crouter Vesuvius. This is a variant of Prunus sericifera. Prunus sericifera is one of the European plums. Seedlings of these can show up. Root suckers of these can show up very commonly. One of the more common identification questions I get from someone who moves into a new yard, and then these woody things start popping up and want to know what it is. I said, well, whoever lived there before you probably had a Crouter Vesuvius plum and took it out, and now the root system is trying to resurrect itself. So you want to keep after that if you don't want a bunch of those. They're not red leaf when they're root suckers. The seedlings are not red leaf. They're perfectly okay little trees, but they can be a bit of a nuisance, especially once you decide to take the tree out after 25 or 30 years. That's pretty much the only drawback, though. Not a lot of fruit on the Crouter Vesuvius, and this very, very pretty spring bloom is just another bonus.
Well, usually I ask you questions about, what's happening at your place, what are you planting, what's blooming, this is March. If I ask you what's blooming, you'll be talking for 2 hours.
It'll be a long conversation. Yes,
it will.
I'll tell you what's blooming. I'll tell you very quickly. Narcissus. And I mean the whole genus. I mean,
it's already done. It's over.
Now you're making the mistake a lot of people make. You're thinking I meant paper whites.
Yeah.
They bloom around Christmas, although I still have some blooming. So those are the Tezeta hybrids. They're technically subtropical in the genus Narcissus. Everything that you call a daffodil is a Narcissus. Everything, all of those are Narcissus. And the actual bloom season for most of them is mid-February through the month of March. So that's when the small cup, the large cup, the trumpet types, the familiar, the species types, those are all blooming. Here in California, we're lucky if you happen to like them, to be able to grow Vitezetta hybrids, which are what most people call paper whites. That's just one strain within the category of Tezetta hybrids. We like them because they start blooming October, November in the case of some of them. Many are in full bloom in December. They're usually even done by the end of January. And they have fragrant flowers, and you're getting color out in your yard in the middle of winter. So that's cool. But that's a very different category. In most parts of the country, most parts of the world, they can't grow those outside. They're subtropicals. They're considered tender. They're like freesias. They don't do them as a garden plant. They do them in containers to enjoy the bloom, you know, early in the season. Here, we're going to stick them in the ground, which, by the way, is what I recommend you do with them. If someone's given you paper whites or something like that, they're done blooming, just put them out in the ground someplace where you don't mind a plant that's going to multiply very freely and bloom with powerful fragrance in the middle of the winter, year after year after year. I have plantings of paper whites that are 45 years old at this point, and they've been increasing steadily that whole time. But when I say narcissus are blooming, I'm referring to daffodils and their ilk. So this is the month of bloom for those.
Jonquils, I think we used to call them back east. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because the jonquil is a common name for members of the genus Narcissus that is used in the UK, as my understanding, and New Zealand and Australia. Any of you listening from those regions, correct me if I'm wrong. But when someone would come in and ask me for jonquil and had a notable accent, I just figured they meant daffodils, because that's their term for what we call daffodils. Or
the King series.
King Alfred is the classic yellow trumpet daffodil.
Yep.
My mother attended a college in the East Coast. She went to Wellesley, if any of you know where that is. Every incoming fresh woman at Wellesley, there was a tradition of that woman going out and planting a single King Alfred daffodil bulb. This was organized. They weren't randomly doing it on campus. And she remembered this years later because they've been doing this for decades. So there are hundreds, probably thousands of King Alfred daffodils planted all over the Wellesley campus. I believe. Anyone went to Wellesley? Anyone go over there? Get some pictures of this and send them to us. And I'll be sure to talk about it, because she thought that was just the most charming tradition to plant a bulb when you started college. King Alfred is the big, familiar yellow trumpet daffodil. It actually fell out of the trade for a long time, but there are a lot of identical yellow trumpet daffodils out there. Dutch Master, Rheinfeld's Early Sensation, and so forth, that, you know, you or I would probably not be able to tell from a King Alfred. About 10, 15 years ago, one of our bulb suppliers, with great fanfare, re-brought King Alfred to the market. They found a source of it, and they multiplied it, and they brought it back to the market. It's a good standard middle of the pack yellow trumpet daffodil, but there's others that are out there. Trumpet daffodils do great. They tend to increase slowly but steadily. Narcissus in general, what we call narcissus, which are usually, in our case, we're referring to cluster blooming members of the genus with smaller flowers, generally multiply even more. In fact, some of them are real spreaders. And when you see the phrase in garden catalogs, naturalizes freely. That can mean anything from, we know this will increase, to watch out where you plant this one. There are very few narcissists that are in the watch out where you plant this one category. Some of them will increase quite a bit. Most of them will increase steadily. And I have areas on my farm where I planted narcissus 10, 15, 20 years ago, where I went from a half dozen bulbs to two or three dozen flowers now in bloom as we speak. And I'm not giving them any care whatsoever. They're getting winter rainfall. Maybe that area is getting irrigated in the summer sometimes. Some of them are out in an area where I don't irrigate at all, and they're absolutely fine with that. So just a reminder, I want to throw this in whenever we talk about bulbs. They're a great addition to a low water landscape. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a native landscape, look for Brodias or some of the other California native bulbs. If you're doing a low water landscape incorporating Mediterranean and plants from Asia Minor and so forth, you have lots of bulbs to choose from. And in California, we can also incorporate bulbs from South Africa and places like that. And most of these require no summer irrigation once established. So they're a really good thing to incorporate to extend the bloom season of your low water landscape, draw pollinators, which most of them do in a big way. And they're just carefree once you plant them. There's even tulips in that category, not the kind you're thinking of, species tulips that will multiply quite freely as well. There are some bulbs that are invasive, and hopefully nurseries aren't selling them. So that yellow oxalis, for example, white calla lilies in the coastal zones. These are ones to be concerned about, and you should find out locally. There's chasmanthi, is a South African bulb that's spreading quite freely in Mendocino County and places like that. So be aware that some of them could be potentially invasive, and you should do a little research on that. But most bulbs are a really good addition to a low water landscape.
So this is March, and we went quickly through what we can plant in March. I should read off that list, but what would be good to plant now? So if somebody comes in, they want their tomatoes, it's not time. What can they do? Can they do potatoes?
Yeah, and this goes for flowers too. There are some flowers that people want that are actually subtropical plants and would be harmed by going in early, others that would just sit there and wait for warmer weather. So in the vegetable garden, you can plant potatoes. This is a great time to plant them. We talked about those last week. You can plant most kitchen herbs except the most popular one. Don't plant basil early. Basil follows the same rules as tomatoes. So if you have them in a pot, sure, put them in a window and enjoy them, but they really shouldn't go in the ground until April.
What's
Root
a
veg.
kitchen herb, Don?
That's an interesting question. I thought
Is
everybody.
it chervil and chives
It's
and
something to me, it's something that you use fresh. So maybe I'm
parsley?
sure. Parsley can go in now. Chervil can go in now. Any of them, actually, there's very few things that can't go in right now. The only thing is that basil, which is by far the most popular summer kitchen herb, is a subtropical to tropical plant and definitely shouldn't go in until we're warmer. But almost all the other things you can think of. Now, I did have someone asking me for tarragon. Tarragon could go in fine, but it's fully dormant right now. If you have tarragon, if you've ever grown it, I use it. And so I have it out in the herb garden. I'd have trouble finding the plant right now if I were looking for it. It's not just dormant, it appears to be gone completely when it's dormant. So
Is
mark the,
it perennial?
yes, it is perennial, but mark the spot because when it goes dormant, it's like completely dormant. So that doesn't usually even show up from my growers until late April or into May because it really needs some heat to sprout and get going and get up to size. But all the other things you're thinking of, rosemary, parsley, sage, rosemary, thyme, those all go in fine. Any of the perennial herbs, chives will just be pushing out of dormancy now, so it's a little, maybe a little early for them to go in, but they will be fine. They're hardy, and that garlic chives will be green and growing. That's one of the reasons nurseries like to sell them. So kitchen herbs can certainly go in. Root vegetables. Radishes, carrots, beets, and you can still plant leafy greens and you can plant Swiss chard. So those can certainly go in anytime. The flower issue. We had someone looking for New Guinea impatiens. New Guinea impatiens are tropical, truly tropical. So I would definitely not put them in any earlier than mid to late April, and they really are happier going in as we get into May. They're really more like peppers and eggplant in that regard. They're worth it. And if you haven't grown New Guinea impatiens and you have a garden that's bright shade, they definitely give probably more pop of color than anything I can think of, but they definitely are tender plants. So it's not that we're worried about frost, where you're very unlikely to have another frost at this point. Just like these summer vegetables, they don't like cold nights. The bedding impatiens used to be a little more tolerant in my experience. They're new hybrids now because of the drastic need a decade ago to get varieties of regular bedding impatiens that were resistant to downy mildew. So I can't tell you for sure whether the new hybrids are as cold tolerant as the older ones. I would probably just hold off on those as well. Fibrous begonias, if you're a shade gardener and you're used to using those little tight bedding begonias, they're fine. They can go in. They would be okay now. My growers have loads of petunias and calibrachoas and all that kind of stuff. They're probably okay. The only problem there, they're coming right out of a greenhouse and going out into your garden. So don't be surprised if the flowers that are on them when you buy them fade quickly or look spoiled within a couple of days simply because of climate shock, environment shock, and they don't put on a lot of new growth right away because the soil is cold, but they'll be okay. They'll come back from it. If you wait a week or so, give them some fertilizer, fish emulsion, or whatever you like to use, you'll get good results. You haven't gained a lot by early planting, but if you've got an event coming up and you want to get some color right beforehand, put them in a couple of days ahead of time. They should still be looking fine. Then they'll go through a period of acclimating to the current temperature conditions before they push out and grow some more. The ones that I don't want you buying or planting now, and I really wish nurseries wouldn't stock them early, zinnias, cosmos, those really need warm soil. So putting them in early really it actually sets them back for the season. So those are things that I personally plant in the month of May and into June.
So, Don, I want to ask a sort of a silly question. It's about water, and it's winter. We had rain. We got water recharging our yards and everything. So, how long does the water in the ground now last as a source of water for my trees? Not the little tiny 3-inch plants,
Oh,
but trees.
well, you can tell by looking at trees when they're beginning to need water. If it's a tree that has a gloss to the leaf and it's looking more dull, if it's a tree that has turgor and is losing the turgor,
That means it's getting limper.
then at least part of the root zone needs to be hydrated. My experience on my property is that I, in the month of April, go through all my irrigation lines, flush them out, and check them and patch the holes made by the ground squirrels and so on. I get everything that takes, it takes a fair period of time. I've got,
You're
13,
huge, I
13,000 feet of drip tubing that I have to monitor. So it takes pretty much the whole month of just walking it and checking them so that I can start irrigating established trees in May. And in most years, that's been fine. Most years, even if we didn't have much rain in April, there's enough soil moisture in my soil in our area that I don't have to worry about it until then. Garden trees, smaller trees, shallower rooted trees like Japanese maples, flowering cherries, things like that. We generally have to start irrigating them sometime in April, every couple weeks. They don't need to be on a frequent cycle, but you'll find they're shallower rooted and the top foot or so of soil is beginning to dry out. They'll show some stress, so it's time to water those. So it really does depend on what the tree is, what the nature of its root system likely is, and most importantly, what your soil is like. But my experience has been I don't really need to start worrying about more established trees on the property, even the ones that I give deep soakings to. I don't really start that until May. I just make sure that the lines are working in the month of April. So I can't give you an absolute answer, but my own experience is check your systems in April, start deep waterings in May. How does your soil compare to Costco?
I what? What?
I don't know. I don't shop at
You don't. Yeah.
Costco.
How would you know? I didn't even know Costco sold soil.
Oh
I
yes,
don't
this
think
is
anybody
so.
sold sells soil.
Of course, Costco sells bagged goods for gardening, just like every other
But
large
that's not
retail
soil.
chain. That's an important point. You're correct. It's not soil. It's usually a mix of compost. But we call things soil in our business that aren't soil. So this could become a very long conversation, or it could just be a, I don't really know. There's so many bagged products and they're so diverse in their contents that it would be almost impossible for me to accurately answer that question. I will say two things. One, Costco has the lowest markup in retail. So if it's there, it's probably cheaper than anywhere else. But you do get what you pay for with soil. You do get what you pay for. The reason one bag of soil is more expensive than another usually has to do with the type of fertilizer that they've chosen to add to the mix, but it may have to do with how much peat moss is in there because that's an expensive additive to many things we call soil in the nursery business. How much perlite or pumice are in there because those are fairly costly for manufacturers to incorporate. There's a whole lot of things in that bag. In order to make a direct comparison, here's what I suggest you do. Flip the bag over because every bag of soil amendment, if you want to use a perhaps more accurate term, compost, planting mix, potting soil, has its ingredients on it by law. They're on there, more or less in the order proportionally that they're in the bag. Not, it doesn't give you the percentages, but at least it tells you what's in there. Take a picture of it. Then go to your favorite garden center, ask if you can flip their bag over, take a picture of that. Compare the ingredients because that's really the most important thing is to know what you're getting. And I would ask you what you're using it for. The biggest mistake I see, and the reason I wanted to address this, is people buying things that are more or less called soil to fill great big raised planters and grow vegetables in them. And then we talk to them in July when the vegetables are not performing well because what they bought either doesn't retain moisture well or doesn't retain nutrients well, or in most cases, both. So you can take that cheap soil. And you can turn it into good garden soil by several steps, which primarily involve top dressing with good quality compost. Or you could have, saved yourself some heartache and by buying a better quality filler in the first place. If you got a big area to fill and you got to bring in topsoil, you're just going to go to a rock yard. And they're going to say that they have something they can blend with compost, okay, 70-30 blend, something like that. They might even call it potting soil or planting mix, or who knows? We have no standards in this industry for what goes on the label. That's an important thing to know. The only regulated terms are organic and compost. Those two words are regulated by the state of California. Beyond that, it's Wild West out there. So, as you're filling it with something that they're telling you is potting soil, ask what the nutrient content is. If it's a good, well-run rock yard, they may even have an analysis of that that they can hand you. They often do batch testing of their soils and they can tell you what's in there. They can tell you if something's been added that contains nitrogen. They may not be able to tell you how much. You can come ask me about that. That's fine. If they say, yeah, we put in 5% horse manure. Okay, happy to talk about the advantages and drawbacks of horse manure. The main thing that you're usually not getting with cheaper soil is nutrients. So just plan on supplementing those. And you may well need to add something to help it retain moisture.
When will we have summer vegetables to plant?
So as soon as we have any sunny weather in late winter, we get a lot of inquiries about summer vegetables. And just very quickly, Every nursery has to decide how you're going to deal with this early season demand. Some really lively and interesting conversations in private nursery Facebook groups about this, ranging from the ones who say, yeah, well, you got a late frost, they'll just come buy more, to those of us who say, you're selling failure. That's probably not the best retail strategy, but everyone has to decide, you know, where you're going to come down. Any of you in Davis who remember Davis Nursery over on H Street, the really nice folks, the Basingers, I'd go over and talk with Tootie Basinger about this issue, and she would just laugh and go, I made a rule, April 1, no vegetable before April 1. I thought, okay, that's reasonable. We understand some people may be seeking to buy early. They're knowledgeable gardeners. They want to transplant them. They want to collect the varieties they're going to get. They will take measures to protect young seedlings when the nights get cold again. They might plant them out and cover them. They might do all that kind of stuff. They understand the drawbacks of early planting. But we have to face the reality that most of the gardeners we're talking to who are coming in because it's a sunny day are not that savvy. And we don't want them just saying, oh, look, tomatoes, let's go put them in the ground, honey. You're not going to get real good results. They may think it's a suitable time for planting because they see the seedling starts in garden centers and hardware stores and especially home improvement chains. No, it's not time here. It's too early. Early planting often leads to worse outcomes overall. That's really the point I want to make. You plant early, you may stunt the plant for the whole season, and we want you to succeed. So we want you to plant when the soil is warm and the plants won't be stressed. Good rule of thumb, put on shorts if you're modest, go out and sit on the ground. If you're cold, the plants will be cold too.
So Don sends me interesting articles occasionally, and this one, he sent me tomatoes, Don's top 20 tomatoes. I'm looking at that thing and I'm going, when was this written? Oh, 2023, 3 years ago. So Don's favorite tomatoes are in here, but I think you've had more tomatoes come that you like in the last 3 years, haven't you?
I like to save these lists and go back and see which ones are consistent on the list. And when I put this list out, there was a new one on there, Bodacious, and there was a new one called Rugby. Well, I really recommend those two now. They wouldn't have been on a list 10 years ago because they weren't even on the market. This article is on the website at redwoodbarn.com. I went ahead and made a link right there on the homepage so you can see this. And these, I would agree, 3 years later, I would agree with these. They're all fine. Early Girl, New Girl, Champion, consistent producer. Bodacious, yeah, if you can get the seed from Burpee or one of the other suppliers. Ace, if you like a good salad tomato, low acid, beautiful fruit, very easy to grow, relatively compact plant. If you're just growing one and you only have a container, Ace is actually a really good large fruited type for that. Of the small fruited types, we've talked about cherry tomatoes, and they are, you know, almost every cherry tomato does extremely well. But the small fruited tomato that outproduces all of them is Juliet. Continues to amaze me 30 plus years after its introduction. Yes, Sun Gold is great. Principe Borghese is one that I always grow for sun drying. 4th of July, the name is correct. It always ripens by first week of July. Chef's Choice Orange, I think very highly of. Lemon Boy, I think very highly of. If you're looking for good orange or yellow tomatoes, there's still two of the best. For sauce tomatoes, Rugby I've mentioned, but you're going to have to order the seed for that. Costoluto Genovese, I love it. It's an Italian heirloom with big meaty fruit, softens quickly, so you got to use it quickly, but it's a very good one. And then of the heirlooms, Cherokee Purple, I'm settling on that one, is probably one of the best producing heirlooms in our area. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I can't remember now, it was my top yielding fruit. I did better than my hybrids, which was pretty amazing. Normally, it's at least right in the middle and good yields almost every year. And Mortgage Lifter, which is a well-known heirloom that's been around for a long time, generally gives me very reliable yields. One that I do grow every year, and almost every year I get very good production on it. Big yellow fruit with red streaks in it, pineapple. And the name comes from its tangy flavor. It actually does have a very rich, tangy flavor.
Jeff Cox says, our notion of what makes a paradise always returns to the image of a beautiful and fruitful garden.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.